Welcome to this Tuesday edition of the Main Street here on the Republic. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up a little bit later in today's show, Dr. Tom Eastern stops by with another one of his Plainsfolk essays, where he'll explore the rich history of Aberdeen Angus cattle on the Northern Plains, tracing their rise from the open range to the carefully bred bloodlines recorded in a quirky 1958 reference book. But we open today's Main Street as we re-air a segment with oncologist and hematologist Dr. Harish Haja from Essentia Health, and he'll be my guest. We discuss alcohol consumption and cancer risk and talk about the complex relationship between alcohol consumption and cancer. And we'll explore the critical questions, including the threshold for safe alcohol use, the types of cancer most strongly linked to alcohol, and the biological mechanisms behind these risks.
It's my pleasure to have you with us on Main Street.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
The topic today is the United States Surgeon General came out and urged warning labels on alcoholic beverages, Doctor, and he essentially has told us one is too many. And we want to get into all of that today. And of course, his link was is that it really increases cancer risk. Does the cancer risk, in your view, increase with any amount of alcohol, or is there a safe threshold?
Yeah, the simple and short answer is there is no safe threshold. There is no safe threshold below which there is no risk. It is estimated that in the U.S. there are approximately 20,000 alcohol-related cancers diagnosed every year. And if you look at the breakdown or the spread of these cancers, of all these 20,000 alcohol-related cancers, 83% occurred in individuals who drank above the recommended drinks per day. But about 17%, roughly one in five that is, occurred in individuals that drank below that level. So clearly this data suggests that there's no threshold below which there is no risk. Cancer can occur for a variety of reasons. Alcohol is just one of them. So you can get cancers, you know, which are non-alcohol related, but studies have shown that there's a relationship between the amount you drink and the duration you drink and the risk of cancer.
Did the Surgeon General's warning surprise you when he came out so forcefully?
So it didn't totally surprise me. It basically just reiterated what we've been reading all along about alcohol and the risks of cancer. This data has been evolving over the last 10, 15 years, and I guess that it was about time that not doing anything was not a good idea. I mean, we really needed to get the information out to the public. And
are there certain types of cancers that have a stronger tie to alcohol?
Yeah, there are at least seven different types of cancers that are definitely linked to alcohol, but there may be more for which strong evidence or data is still being looked at. So the seven types of cancers that are alcohol related for sure are mouth cancer, larynx cancer, throat cancer, esophagus cancer, that's the food pipe, liver cancer, colorectal cancers, and breast cancers in females.
But we've all heard of studies. Some have said, hey, a drink a day is good for your heart. What should we be thinking about those things that we remember from back in the day?
Well, I think there's a need to relook at our guidelines and relook at what updates we need to make to our guidelines. Clearly, data has evolved over the last few years that suggests that any form of drinking, however little, is detrimental to your health from a cancer standpoint. There could be some benefits. For example, alcohol has been shown in very small amounts to reduce the risk of blood clots and strokes, but that data also is not validated. Mm-hmm. So I think if you look at that small benefit versus the excessive risks of alcohol intake, the math clearly tells you that the risks are far greater than the benefits.
Do we know how alcohol contributes to the development of cancer? at the cellular level or molecular level for a dummy like me that doesn't understand all of the intense science?
Yeah, sure. It's actually quite interesting. So when one ingests alcohol, it goes into your stomach and then goes into the small intestine, from where it is absorbed into the blood, and then it's taken to the liver. So in the liver, there is an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase, and the short form of which is ADH. So this alcohol dehydrogenase, and the levels in individuals vary, you know, you can have a high level, I could have a low level, and so on and so forth. So the amount of the enzyme matters in terms of how much it metabolizes the alcohol. So alcohol via this enzyme and through two or three other enzymes is ultimately converted into acetaldehyde in the body. Now, acetaldehyde is a genotoxin. That means it can bind to DNA, creating DNA aldehyde adducts, which increase the risk of mutations in the DNA of an individual. And so if those mutations occur in genes that, say, for example, control cell growth or proliferation, you can imagine how that process could be thrown off track, and that may ultimately result in cancer. So that's just one of the mechanisms, but there are others. For example, in females, we know that alcohol increases estradiol or estrogen levels in the blood, and we know that estrogen or estradiol is a risk factor for breast cancer in women. There are other ways, I think, that it can cause cancer. Another postulated mechanism is that alcohol can act as a solvent for other carcinogens. So, for example, if you smoke and drink at the same time, the carcinogens in tobacco can be dissolved in alcohol. Alcohol also changes the cellular structure of the cells in the mouth. So along with the change in the cellular structure and the carcinogens dissolving in the alcohol, you can imagine how that can easily lead to carcinogenesis in the oral cavity.
Is all alcohol the same? In other words, is beer different from wine, different from spirits relative to risk?
So you have to understand, or you have to know what the amount of alcohol in each of these drinks is. So if you take a can of beer, you know, that contains about 14 grams of alcohol. Basically, a glass of wine, which is roughly 5 ounces, will also contain the same amount. If you take hard liquor, for example, just an ounce and a half will contain about 14 grams of alcohol. So each of these drinks has enough alcohol in them, the way we currently consume them, that there shouldn't be any difference in the cancer risk. And we see that from studies.
Is it the case that people that have one drink a week are less likely, does the data show, than someone who has a drink every day versus somebody who has two or three drinks a day?
Yeah, absolutely. According to current medical research, like I said, no amount is safe. And let me give you an example about this relationship between the amount of alcohol consumed and the risk of cancer. So I have actually looked up some studies, and there was a recent study that was a pooled analysis of like 26 different studies. And it was found that for oral cavity cancer or mouth cancer, the relative odds of developing cancer increased by 40% for those who consumed about a drink daily compared to those who did not or drank less than one drink a day.
40%.
And I'll explain to you what that, it is important to understand.
It seems substantial.
So I'm going to explain to you what the difference between, you have to understand what a relative risk is and what an absolute risk is. And I'll come to that in just a minute. But just to kind of give you an idea of the different studies out there, there was another pooled analysis of like a million women and found that the relative risk of breast cancer increased by 10% for women who consumed one drink daily compared to those who did not drink. And a third global study also found an association between the higher the alcohol you took in, the higher the risk. Now, here's where the understanding about the relative and absolute risk comes in. And that's very important to understand. So the key words are relative and absolute. So when when we talk about these risks, you have to understand that a large change in the relative risk could mean a very small risk in absolute terms. So let's explain. So let's say the risk of drowning in the US is about 1 in 1,000. And then a certain behavior, for example, increases that risk by, let's say, 100%. So that 100% is a big number. But in absolute terms, 100% increase of 1 is 2. So the number of individuals at risk because of this behavior of, say, let's say, alcohol drinking and drowning, you increase the risk from 1 to 2. So the absolute increase is 1, but the relative increase is 100%. So you have to make sure that you understand those terms correctly. So when I say there's a 40% relative risk increase, it means 40% of what your baseline risk is. So if your risk is 2 for a certain event to occur, then 40% of that would be, you know, 0.4 times 2 would be, you know, 0.8.
Less than 3. Yeah,
so it'll be less than 3 in absolute terms, you know. So yeah, it's important to understand that. So while these risks may appear very large, the absolute risk is small.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Harish Ahuja, a hematologist and oncologist with Essentia Health. And we're discussing the new research that says even moderate drinking increases cancer risk, challenging perceptions of its health benefits. Are people genetically predisposed to cancer risks because of alcohol intake, do you think, doctor?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, like I said, again, the data is not conclusive, but we know that we all metabolize or activate alcohol into acetaldehyde at different levels in our body. So the enzyme that is important is the alcohol dehydrogenase, like I mentioned before. So if someone has a very high level of this enzyme, the amount of acetaldehyde that will be created is higher than someone whose enzyme level is low, where the acetaldehyde level will be lower. So there seems to be a relationship between the levels of these enzymes, and these are normal variations in individuals from one individual to the other. So the more the aldehyde that is produced, the higher the risk, and that is a theory out there, yeah.
Can we reduce alcohol consumption or quit entirely and also then reduce our cancer risk, or are we stuck with our history?
That's a good question. So in order to answer that question, we basically have to realize that there are genetic factors that predispose individuals to cancer. So let's talk about some of these common ones. So BRCA1 and BRCA2, or also known as BRCA1 and BRCA2, are genes that we all have. They help us repair damaged DNA. So if these genes are mutated, DNA cannot be repaired. And so that results in an increased cancer incidence. So women who have BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutations tend to develop, you know, breast cancers at a very high frequency. Similarly, they tend to develop ovarian cancers at a high frequency. Men who have mutations in these genes develop prostate cancers at a high frequency. So obviously, when you drink and you have a genetic predisposition to cancer already, it sort of intuitively makes sense that you will increase your risk of these cancers that the genes predispose to. While it may sound intuitively reasonable, I don't think we have strong evidence to link the two. But studies definitely need to be done in this area. Similarly, there is another gene called mismatch repair gene, which is responsible for colorectal cancers. It's part of a syndrome that we call Lynch's syndrome. Again, you know, with the increased risk of colorectal cancers occurring in the setting of alcohol intake, and this gene already predisposing you to develop colorectal cancer, is there a multiplication or synergistic effect? I think those studies haven't been done, or the evidence is so far inconclusive.
Let me ask you this question. Do we know whether lifestyle factors, such as someone who's healthy and fit, mm-hmm, versus somebody who's overweight, they both drink a little bit, is it worse for one than the other?
Again, the same answer applies to this as your previous question. I mean, we know that there are other lifestyle risk factors, obesity, sedentary lifestyle, eating processed meats in excess, you know, drinking alcohol, smoking, you know, obesity, all of these basically, all of these lifestyle risk factors can increase cancers. And do we multiply the risk by taking alcohol and adding to the risk? We don't know that for sure at this point. And that's another area that there are gaps in our knowledge.
There are many people listening who like to have a beer with dinner. They like to go out and they like to have a drink. From your perspective, has your message now changed a little bit to those folks? What would you tell them?
So as a medical community, I think, you know, we need to do more. You know, we basically know from our smoking studies that, you know, smoking cessation has been a front and center risk-reducing strategy in our country. You know, once the advisories from the Surgeon General came out about smoking, you know, there has been a drastic decrease in the incidence of tobacco-related cancers. This, combined with the medical community taking on the challenge of empowering patients with the knowledge about alcohol and its risks, you know, having screening programs for alcohol out there, public education, you know, those are things that I think would make a big difference. Yeah. And so as a medical community, I think we need to emphasize and take a leaf out of what we did with tobacco. And we can already see the effects of that, the positive effects of that.
The playbook maybe has been written. Let me ask you this question in preparing for this interview. Germany has recommendations about alcohol consumption. Mm. Great Britain has recommendations about alcohol consumption in their National Health Service. So does Canada. So does the United States too, quite frankly. Mm. Now is the recommendation, don't.
Yeah, so if there was a nice survey done recently, and I forget who did it, but in that survey, they surveyed a large number of adults in the U.S., and they were trying to find out through that survey what did individuals perceive as risk for cancer. So when it came to radiation, about 90% knew that radiation is a risk factor. When it came to smoking, close to 85-90% knew that that is a risk factor, but only 40-45% perceived alcohol as a risk factor, you know. So I think based on this, we definitely need to educate people out there. In fact, if you look at the global platform, the WHO actually has an initiative called the SAFER, S-A-F-E-R initiative, where it recommends that nations should increase excise taxes and minimal unit pricing to make it less affordable. There's also recommendations to limit the availability of alcohol by restricting where and when it can be sold. They also recommend regulating marketing and banning and limiting advertisement and sponsorship of alcohol drinks. And also they recommend raising the awareness as far as the public is concerned. So you're right, different countries have different recommendations. But there are at least, to my knowledge, 47 countries that require alcohol warning labels related to health and safety of alcohol. South Korea requires a cancer-specific warning on all its alcoholic drinks. And in come 2026, Ireland, the government in Ireland recently signed into law a new requirement to display a cancer warning label on all alcoholic beverages. And so this label will, and I quote, say the following: there is a direct link between alcohol and fatal cancer. So that label is going to be on all alcoholic drinks in Ireland come 2026.
The home of good Irish beer.
And it's ironical, it's coming from Ireland. I mean, yeah.
I want to change gears just a little bit, and I want to let our listeners know that I warned you I would ask this question, but I think it's relevant. With recreational cannabis soon to be legal in a state right next door to us and is already legal in Montana, should some people look to switching to cannabis instead of using alcohol? Do we have recommendations or guidance about that? Or again, do we just not know enough to make a recommendation?
Well, we do know that cannabis can increase the risk of several cancers. I mean, you know, again, there are gaps in our knowledge about the incidence and so on and so forth. But various cancers have been linked to cannabis use. Chief among them is testicular cancer in young males, you know. And so there's studies showing that there is a risk there. And there are other cancers as well. But again, I don't think we've had enough studies to just like we do with tobacco and alcohol. But I think over the next few years, that probably will be the next U.S. Surgeon General's warning, but data is lacking at this point.
Do you think the Surgeon General got it right relative to his alcohol warnings, Doctor?
If you ask me, yes. Obviously, there are people who would disagree, but I happen to believe yes. And again, you know, there are obviously people out there and advocates out there, especially from the alcohol industry, who claim that this is all epidemiological evidence and there are no randomized studies, which is the gold standard for anything to become a standard. But to do a randomized study is going to be horrendously difficult. You have to have thousands and thousands of people or individuals. One of them will drink alcohol, one will not, one will drink, one will not. And so, and at the end of several years, you will know for sure. But I think the evidence from epidemiological studies is strong enough that I think not doing anything at this point would be dangerous for the public itself.
We've enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Harish Ahuja, a hematologist and oncologist at Essentia Health. We've been talking about the United States Surgeon General's recent warnings, urging warning labels on alcoholic beverages to highlight their link to at least seven cancers. Research shows even moderate drinking now increases cancer risk, challenging perceptions of its health benefits. Some interesting messaging, I think, will be following this, Doctor, from both sides now. I think that the beverage industry is going to counter this and continue to advertise a lot, and the medical community perhaps now
will take it more seriously and start, you know, educating people and screening for alcohol use and, you know, making this new finding or recent findings available to the public, then the public will have to make a decision.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
No worries. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll visit with our great friend, Dr. Tom Easern, and we'll hear another of his Plains Folk essays. This one on the rich history of Aberdeen Angus cattle in the region. Plus, we'll catch another episode of Our Native Lands. And we'll also hear from a podcast we produce right here at Prairie Public. It's called In Session, which will keep you updated on the North Dakota legislative session. That's all still ahead on Main Street right after this.
Hi, I'm Rick Gion, Major Gifts Manager here at Prairie Public. When you give to Prairie Public, you hear your donation at work. Your generosity helps everyone in the Prairie region have access to programs that educate, involve, and inspire. If you'd like to pay Prairie Public forward in an even more impactful way, I invite you to join our Investor Circle. It's a group of members who care deeply about Prairie Public and who want quality, non-commercial programming and fact-driven news to touch even more people in our communities. Become an Investor Circle member right now with a gift of $1,200 or more annually or at $100 per month. Go to prairiepublic.org/support for more details. And thank you for caring about Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Dr. Tom Easern's Plainsfolk essays explore the rich history of Aberdeen Angus cattle on the Northern Plains, tracing their rise from the open range to the carefully bred bloodlines recorded in a quirky 1958 reference book. Through stories of determined stockmen, visionary railroad magnates, and legendary geneticists, Ezern unpacks how these blocky black cattle and the people who raised them shaped the region's agricultural legacy.
If in your historical memory, the open range of the northern Badlands is fully stocked with lanky longhorns, then it's time for a reset. With the opening of the Northern Pacific Railroad Bridge at Bismarck in 1882, shorthorn cattle, purchased in the northern Midwest, flowed in freely. In the Medora office of the Badlands Cowboy, editor A.T. Packard was thinking further ahead, envisioning herds without horns, polled animals, preferably those blocky black beasts known as Aberdeen Angus. His self-declared crusade for the Angus breed was inspired by Dr. J.J. Clemmer of Iowa, who with his partner, G.M. Dell, had brought a $600 Angus bull to their place in the Cave Hills in 1885. Within a few years, Dr. A.C. McGillivray would attract considerable press attention to his Indian Springs ranch, where he built a great stone barn to house the 40 black heifers he had shipped in. Along the Great Northern Line, fortunate stockmen benefited from the foresight of James J. Hill, who shipped in carloads of registered bulls for free distribution. By 1885, Hill's operatives brought Angus bulls to be unloaded at stations west of Larimore. The first Aberdeen Angus stock in America, in fact, four fine bulls, was imported direct from Scotland to the Great Plains in 1874 by George Grant of Victoria, Kansas. Swiftly, other Western stockmen arranged their own importations. Angus cattle, for all their blockiness, proved remarkably good rustlers on the range and fattened easily, producing their signature marbled beef. Stockmen were particularly enamored with prospects for crossbreeding with shorthorns, a practice well established in Scotland that had come to dominate the London markets. Which brings us to the quirky little green book now in my hand, Aberdeen Angus Bloodlines, published by the Institute for Regional Studies at NDSU in 1958. Author, one Charles J. Christians, whose obituary tells me he was an Iowa boy who came west to North Dakota Agricultural College and studied animal husbandry with the legendary geneticist, a man of whom many declared they never saw him without his signature pipe, M. L. Buck Buchanan. And speaking of bloodlines, it was Buck Buchanan's equally distinguished son, Dave Buchanan, president of the American Society of Animal Science in 2005 and 6, who helped me sort out the story of the green spiral-bound Bloodlines book. Buck Buchanan served NDAC, then NDSU, from 1945 to 1976. Dave's NDSU service was from 2007, when he arrived from Oklahoma State, to 2023. When I sat down with Dave, he had brought his well-preserved copy of Aberdeen Angus Bloodlines, and I had my disheveled library copy. He showed me how to look up a bull in the index, then trace its lineage all the way back to gray-breasted Jock 113, who stands where time began for the Angus breed in 1840. Christian's card index of all the top bulls from the six great stock shows was converted into an ingenious herd book with gray-breasted Jock 113 and one branch of his prodigy on the first page, and every page thereafter tracing another branch, the page cut short at the top to reveal the earlier generations. It's hard to describe, but it works. I envision this slender reference protruding from the coat pocket of every Angus lover at the Denver Stock Show, or the Little International at NDSU, a marker of two lineages, one bovine, the other human.
That was Tom Ezer, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, bringing us another of his Plains Folk essays.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Climate change is making life harder for reservation dogs. The Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Merzbach spoke with Grist reporter Taylor Stagner about how these furry friends are being affected by extreme weather, like wildfires, which can happen year-round in the West.
Taylor, thanks so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Hannah.
So you recently wrote a story for Grist titled, Res Dogs Are Feeling the Heat from Climate Change. Your story focuses on the San Carlos Apache Reservation down in southeast Arizona. Tell me what you were hearing from people there.
The issue seemed, well, particularly dire because they had just gone through this horrible fire earlier in the summer. It devastated the community. It destroyed 20 homes, about 2,000 acres. And the person that I found, her name was Julie Cazador, and she's Apache. And she was running around trying to save all these dogs.
I've been rescuing for now 13 years, actively for like 7 years.
The dogs had burnt paws. And so she was like out there rescuing them. And she was out there doing that, she said, until midnight or so. And they don't have a shelter. So they had to like makeshift a shelter, which is really rough to do, especially when, you know, the world's on fire and you're trying to find a safe place to put these animals. And also people are having a hard time finding places to be.
The animals are like forgotten. So we fundraise for the funding for the pets that were burnt.
They recently got approval from their tribal council to build a shelter there. So they'll be more prepared in the future for the increasing wildfires that we're seeing here in the West.
That's great to hear. Were you seeing these climate change impacts across reservations across the West?
So it's definitely not all reservations, but there was a few, and there was enough in my reporting to see that there was a problem, because while reservation dogs are beloved by their community, and what I heard from many caregivers is that they're quite adaptable. They're very spunky, I guess. They can really adapt to many different shifts in climate, because they do exist in these more harsh situations than, you know, a dog that stays inside. They're almost wildlife. I mean, it's kind of interesting to think of them that way. But shelters everywhere are experiencing just an influx in animals, and they're just having a hard time placing them. And some of them end up just roaming around and, you know, maybe without water. It's getting to the point where if creeks and places are drying up like any other animal, they're having a hard time finding resources.
Yeah. Will you walk me through the numbers on this?
There really isn't one hub of like how many dogs that are in foster care and shelters. The American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals gave me some recent numbers. So in shelters across the country, there's about 6.5 million dogs and cats entering shelters, but only about 4.8 million get adopted. That gives you kind of a countrywide scale of like what's going on. But as far as like how many locally, like those regional numbers are really hard. I mean, a lot of places are at capacity. Going back to Julie on the San Carlos Reservation, I mean, it was her and a group of Apache volunteers.
I'm doing it because no one's helping their animals, not with dog food, not with cat food. So someone has to do it, and no one wants to do it. So I took on the task with other volunteers.
And they are still, you know, building that capacity. It's just really difficult when you're looking at the scale of the problem. But that's one thing that I think is really important. Pretty much everywhere I called, people were very excited about this work and very like dedicated to it, which was very heartening. It was very like, wow, this is being addressed despite lack of resources. Hopefully people understand like how climate change is going to make the problem worse, not better. Especially with these wildfires, extreme weather, it's going to make some of our most vulnerable people, but also animals. It's going to make it worse for everyone.
That was Taylor Stagner, who reports on tribal affairs for the climate-focused publication Grist. You can check out her story titled, Res Dogs Are Feeling the Heat from Climate Change, at grist.org. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
You know what's coming up this week?
My
My funny Valentine.
It's not Valentine's Day. Super early Easter?
Alas, no. It's the deadline for property taxes, at least if you want to get a 5% discount, which I do, so I paid mine in full. I bring it up because there is a bill making its way through the legislature that would increase the tax credit.
What I've always liked about tax credits, they feel like free money.
On this episode of In Session, we take a look at bills that would pay for things, lessen the costs for you and me, that make it feel like we're getting free things.
So we'll look at property tax relief, school meals, and media. So let's get an update on property tax relief. It was Governor Armstrong's State of the State, you might recall, recommending.
First, we propose increasing the existing primary residence credit from $500 to $1,000 per year at a cost to the general fund of $310 million. In addition, we will create a primary residence classification, so this relief will become automatic and not require homeowners to file for a credit. Second, our plan will use a dedicated stream of legacy fund earnings to provide additional funds to the primary resident credit. This stream will grow as the fund grows, giving every North Dakota homeowner a direct stake in the overall success of the legacy fund.
So that last bit about tapping into the legacy fund, that's the fund that's set up to grow the wealth from the oil boom. That's the piece of this legislation that really allows North Dakota to potentially free up dollars for homeowners.
In the governor's recommendation, he was looking at over $1,500 or the average property tax that homeowners pay.
So that's changed to $1,450 as the House Bill 1176 has made its way through committee. So a little less than the original, but still a significant chunk of change freed up for homeowners.
And you know, I've got a little girl, and I've been following the discussion over free lunch. Gotta admit, that sounds pretty good to me as a parent.
This is a bill that pretty much everyone agrees on. It would put $140 million towards meals, breakfast, and lunch for any student in North Dakota.
Even kids who go to private school?
Yeah, and that was a criticism. But by and large, the arguments you heard in the committee hearing was about jobs and the economy.
And conversely, when meal participation declines, hours and jobs are often reduced. So again, with that anticipated 20% increase in breakfast and 15% increase in lunch, this would directly translate into more job opportunities within the communities.
The common sense argument.
We don't charge families in our schools for their children to use district equipment like Chromebooks, iPads, textbooks, computer labs, or to participate in field experiences. Why? Because we realize that these are important educational components which are vital to ensuring meaningful educational experiences for our students.
And the populist argument.
Additionally, there may be no simpler idea proposed this legislative session to put hard-earned dollars back into the working families' pockets than House Bill 1475. This bill, if passed, will be an investment not only in our children's academic success, but also in thousands of working families across the state.
Well, it just seems like everybody would have an interest in kids having good nutrition, you know, and that's the brain power that gets them through the day, right? But how would these meals be paid for? And if I'm not paying for it as a parent, where is the money coming from?
Well, start where it's not coming from, and that would be the legacy fund. House Bill 1553 would have paid for free school meals out of the legacy fund, but it got shot down in the House. So that leaves House Bill 1475. That would allocate the $140 million from the general fund. And that did get a due pass. And as of this taping, it will go to the House Appropriations Committee.
Well, and I know that a due pass doesn't always mean that the full House will support a bill, or even a do not pass means the full House will vote something down. And that happened with our next topic about what is free or what is helped to be free, and that is us, Prairie Public.
House Bill 1255, it would prohibit state officers from expending either state or federal funds to directly or indirectly support public broadcasting.
I remember that bill got a do not pass. Remember it very well. We were very optimistic around here. And then it went to the House floor where it did pass 61-32. But that wasn't the end of the story, because last week it got kicked back to the Appropriations Committee.
I know, it's
back
and
forth.
It's like a tennis game.
Totally. Wimbledon and Bismarck there.
Every morning, every evening, ain't we got fun? Not much money, oh, but honey, ain't we got fun?
So yeah, I did go back to the Appropriations Committee, and I know when you and I were talking about one issue in particular and do the deep dive, but we were noticing this theme.
Yeah, free is the theme, Anne. Things that the state could pick up the tab for that would have really impact on families and everyday people. But media isn't something we think about as free. I have subscriptions to various streaming services. I have subscriptions to newspapers that have paywalls. But when we talked, I was reminded of everything that we produce and distribute here at Prairie Public is free.
Paying for media, it's just become a fact of life. But we don't have a paywall at Prairie Public. You can read Dave Thompson's news articles for free. You can subscribe to his newsletter, Do You Know Deck.
Do You Know Deck, prairiepublic.org.
Do you? You can watch for free on our television service. When you're in your car, you can listen for free. And in wonky terms, it's what's referred to as universal service.
Ah, right. The idea that everyone, no matter where they live or their circumstances, has access for free. And the state support Prairie Public gets, which was $1.2 million in the last session, that helps us keep our towers up. And those towers, they're getting a little bit long in the tooth. I know that came up in the appropriations meeting because on paper, it looks like we have all this money, but we have millions of dollars in depreciating assets, which are those 39 towers that make Daniel Tiger, Prairie Public News, the PBS News Hour free for you and for me.
And that's how Representative Longmire teed it up.
Committee had on that is not all people are on cable TV or have internet, and Prairie Public Broadcasting covers a lot of areas where their socioeconomics are not as high as some others and provides a very valuable service to these people.
But at the end of the hearing, there was this moment, and it's a rare moment that you hear at a legislative session.
I was foolish. I voted no to do not pass. Only voting no meant that I was voting against Prairie Public.
Yeah, that is very rare to hear an elected official in 2025 say he was foolish.
And then
I'll admit that I was.
I'm glad to hear you weren't the only one, Representative Martinson.
Well, you looked at it too.
I made a mistake.
They thought they were voting to support Prairie Public subsidy.
You know, this is something that I really love about North Dakota. I love the fact that we can have these moments of humanity in our legislative session. I've been listening to a lot of committee hearings. I've been listening to testimony from everyday folks testifying, but just like hearing these legislators just own up to the fact they made a mistake. They actually meant to support this appropriation for Prairie Public. And I have a lot of sympathy for them, Eric. I have a spreadsheet to track these bills for this podcast preparation. A
lot of numbers to keep track of.
I mean, there were over 1,000 bills in the hopper. These legislators are spending hours and hours and hours, and it's a tight timeline. And so when you get to a vote with a do not pass recommendation, vote no and do not pass, that's a double negative. What does it mean? It's a lot to keep track of.
Right, right. I had to kind of look at my notes as if I'm saying that right or not. So, I mean, I hope I get this number right. 1255. It goes back to the House floor as of this taping for yet another vote. Okay, Anne, let's start with the first number in our three numbers weekly wrap-up.
10, as in the Ten Commandments. House Bill 1145 was voted down on the floor. The bill would have required public schools and colleges to post the Ten Commandments. What's your number, Eric?
2026. That is a year. The last year, Democratic U.S. Senator from Minnesota Tina Smith will serve in Washington, putting one of two Senate seats in play for Republicans to expand on their majority in the U.S. Senate. Smith just announced she will not be seeking another six-year term. Peggy Flanagan, who would have become the first Native American governor had Kamala Harris and Tim Walz won the White House, she has thrown her hat in the ring for this Senate seat.
And for our last number, because it's been coming up a lot, $11 billion.
Billion with a big B, Ann.
For big number.
Yeah.
That's how much money is in the North Dakota Legacy Fund as of November 2024. We'll do a deeper dive under the Legacy Fund at some point. It's coming up a lot in the state legislation that's being debated right now. But it's also become a national topic with President Trump talking about setting up a sovereign wealth fund.
Oh, I can't wait to hear about the Sovereign Wealth Fund and diving into that. So you can learn about it here on In Session. Thanks to our production wizard, Tay Calloway, who is Prairie Public's radio studio operator. Christine McClellan is our communications manager, and Leah Peterson is Prairie Public's digital communications specialist.
See you next week.
The North Dakota Council on the Arts annual grant application season is now open. The agency provides funding for arts and education, accessibility, community arts, and folk arts, supporting projects and activities that enrich North Dakota's cultural landscape. Grants and training programs are available to assist artists, educators, and organizations in bringing creative ideas to life. More information on funding opportunities and application deadlines can be found at arts.nd.gov/grants.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 18th. When the U.S. Constitution was adopted in 1788, the framers faced a challenge: how to balance the representation of large states with fair treatment for smaller ones. They designed Congress to ensure fair representation for all states, regardless of size. The House of Representatives allotted seats based on population, giving larger states more representatives. To balance this, the Senate gave every state 2 senators, regardless of size. Representatives were elected by voters, but senators were chosen by state legislatures, meaning voters had no direct say. The framers believed that state political leaders would feel included in the federal system, which would ease concerns about a strong central government. Since voters elected their state legislators, they would indirectly have a say in Senate elections. However, the system had issues. Senate vacancies could last for months while state legislatures argued over appointments. If political machines or special interests controlled state legislatures, the Senate could be influenced by these interests. Voters began to complain that the Senate had become a millionaire's club. It became clear that the system wasn't working as intended. Over half the states introduced state primary elections, allowing voters to choose their senators, with candidates pledging to honor the results. In 1911, Senator Joseph Bristow of Kansas introduced an amendment for the direct election of senators, creating a uniform system across the country. The House passed the amendment in 1912, and it went to the states for ratification. For it to become part of the Constitution, 3/4 of the states needed to approve it. Massachusetts was the first to vote in favor on May 22, 1912. On this date, February 18, 1913, the North Dakota legislature ratified the amendment, making North Dakota the 22nd state to approve it. After 36 states ratified the amendment, the 17th Amendment became law on April 8, 1913. Interestingly, Delaware did not ratify the amendment until 2010. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
As German voters head to the polls, the country's economy is still in a recession.
Globalization is in retreat. Chinese want to produce for themselves. Americans want to produce for themselves. The euro is still there, okay? We have to take care of our own military now, and the cheap energy supplies from Russia are gone as well.
That story on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for joining us. We're deeply grateful that you had time to spend with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll visit with Dr. Kameen Samuel, the first African-American woman to be a helicopter pilot in the United States Navy. She has produced the upcoming documentary, Courage to Thrive, which highlights tangible tools for women to create breakthrough results despite facing adversity. That's tomorrow, right here on Main Street, here on Prairie Public. And we hope you can join us again.